Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unusual mass shooting in Canada at a mosque in Quebec City that left 6 worshippers dead, 5 in critical condition and 12 others injured. Mubin Sheikh, the author of Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West, joins us. A former jihadist, Mubin came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teachings of the Quran, and he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. We will discuss what motivated the suspect, Alexandre Bissonnette, who on his Facebook page says he likes Donald Trump and Marine Le Pen, France's anti-immigrant right-wing political leader, and how the shooter got hold of an AK-47 assault rifle, which is banned in Canada but readily available across the border in the US. Then we'll look into the extent to which Donald Trump's remarks about redoing the Iraq war and this time stealing Iraq's oil, as well as his Muslim ban that name Iraq as one of the 7 Islamic countries whose citizens are banned from entering the US, are going down with Iraqis, and how it is affecting the 7,000 US soldiers and contractors who are fighting alongside Iraqis against the Islamic State. Iraq expert Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, joins us to discuss the blowback in the Islamic world from Trump's Muslim ban and how much it plays into the hands of the Islamic State. Then finally, we'll speak with an expert in administrative procedure and regulatory policy, Sydney Shapiro, the vice president of the Center for Progressive Reform and chair of administrative law at Wake Forest University. He joins us to attempt to understand Trump's latest 2-out, 1-in executive order to scrap 2 regulations for each new one, which appears to be as radical as it is unworkable. We will discuss the coming legal entanglement and the arbitrary Sophie's Choice aspect of enacting a new regulation to protect public health, which means you are forced to get rid of 2 older regulations that have protected public health. And joining us now is Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questioned his extremist interpretation of Islam, then spent 2 years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teachings of the Quran. After returning to Canada in 2004, he became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and he's one of the few people in the world to have been undercover in Al-Qaeda-inspired domestic terror groups. And Mubin has testified in multiple legal hearings, resulting in the prosecution and conviction of 11 aspiring terrorists. And he's the author of Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mubin Sheikh.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Mubin, this horrible shooting that took place on Sunday night in the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center, 6 people were killed, 5 are in critical condition, and 12 others suffered minor injuries. This is extremely unusual to happen in Canada. It's much more frequent here in the United States to have mass shootings. The gun laws, of course, are much tighter in Canada. And also in the context of what we're experiencing now in the United States with Donald Trump shutting the door on Muslims coming into the United States with protests at airports around the United States, there's very much a sense of a contrast, if you will, between America's new xenophobic, unwelcoming stance on immigration compared to Canada's welcoming stance. So a lot to talk about. Let's begin with the person who's been arrested. There were 2 people allegedly arrested, one of whom turned out to be a witness. But what do we know about the possible shooter here? A French-Canadian, his name is a student, I believe, Alexandre Bissonnette.
That's right. So as you mentioned, initially what had happened was the police, I mean, the reports were they had taken 2 people into custody, or you know, they had possession of 2 people. And I think some of the reports indicated they were both suspects. But it turned out, in fact, that they were, one was the suspect. The other was actually the Muslim guy who was praying in the mosque. So when initially people heard it's a white guy and a brown guy named Muhammad, you know, all sorts of conspiracy theories. And it was very odd. It didn't fit the script, of course. what did fit the script is that the Muhammad guy was actually in the mosque praying. Alexander Bissonnet is a former army cadet. He was a college student. He was actually a troll on a pro-refugee Facebook page. He posted a lot of right-wing views. He had right-wing views, was a Trump supporter, a supporter of Marine Le Pen, the French nationalist leader in France, of course. And, I mean, in general, in Quebec, Canada, there is a big presence of far-right type groups, two in particular that are known in Europe. One is Pegida, and the other is Soldiers of Odin that are present in Quebec City. So not saying that these are the groups that committed the attacks, just saying that that's the context from which a guy like Alexander Bissonnet emerges.
Well, Quebec, of course, is the home to many refugees from French-speaking North African countries, like Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. But on the other hand, since it's French-speaking, most of the Quebecois came from France itself, and it obviously has cultural ties to France. Does that mean that the political influence of Marine Le Pen, and let's face it, she could well become the next president of France, is that also infiltrating Quebec?
Oh, yes. I mean, of course, the Quebecois and the whole French distinct society, that Quebec as a distinct society, is something that we respect in Canada. It's part of our constitution. It's part of our national narrative, if you will. And definitely what happens in France has a great impact. So what happens in Quebec, the sentiments that are expressed in France are echoed very regularly in Quebec. So, I mean, of course, this is going to play into that dynamic. And as well, reinforce and exacerbate the tensions between the Muslim population and others in Quebec who may not be as tolerant as the rest.
And what about the presence of refugees from French-speaking North African Muslim countries like Morocco, where this witness, who I believe was driving home, and he called into the police on his mobile phone and was pulled over and initially thought to be somehow a suspect when in fact he was a witness. He's from Morocco, I believe.
Right.
So what's, do you have any numbers on that in terms of a diaspora in Quebec?
Well, in terms of Moroccans in Quebec, I don't know how many in how many exactly. I mean, you're dealing with, of course, as you noted, from other areas as well, Algerians, others, like you said. But I think there is a 2011 census. I'm looking at something here, a 2011 census that claims 71,910 Canadians of that background. I don't see anything from Quebec per se. Mm-hmm. But a significant population in Quebec, Moroccans, Algerians in particular, just like in France, just like in Belgium in the French areas as well.
And I'm correct in the premise that Canada has been both more welcoming and more integrating, if that's the right word, of its Muslim populations.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we do very well up here and we pride ourselves on is celebrating diversity as a source of strength. And this is, certainly being part of the message that Canada has been putting out, especially after the President Trump's Muslim ban. The Prime Minister of Canada put out a tweet, you're welcome to Canada, whatever your background, whatever your religion, diversity is a source of strength. So those who are anti-refugee types, they don't like that. They don't like to see this kind of overt, openly positive narrative towards Muslims, towards immigrants. And, I mean, this is actually part of the problem in other countries where, there's a need to want to be able to criticize Muslims in the name of free speech, but then not say anything good about Muslims. So this one-way track, it can only lead to one place, and that is division, strife and tension. And that is never in the national security interest of any country.
Well, let's focus on your experiences, Mubin, because this person, of course, Alexandre Bissonnet, is a French-Canadian, a Quebecois, who murdered six people, wounded five others critically, 12 others wounded as well. He shot, I think most of these people were shot in the back while they were at prayer on Sunday evening in the Quebec Islamic Cultural Center mosque. But nevertheless, you have been involved in undercover work in order to arrest real jihadis, not innocent victims like we're talking about here. So how does that square with what we're talking about here in terms of Canada being successful in its integration and welcoming of immigrants from Muslim countries?
Yeah, well, you know, the whole point is that we have to do things professionally, right? And there are always tensions between police agencies, national security agencies. There's a healthy mistrust, I think, between the two. You know, the public wants, you know, complete freedom. The government wants to be able to monitor everything, you know, in case something goes wrong. And, you know, general public tends not to like this justification of, in case something goes wrong, you know, monitor everything. So it's in the middle, of course, somewhere. Intelligence agencies trying to do things by the book, you know, by the law, because when these investigations lead to criminal charges, which are then brought into court, you have to make sure that it's done correctly, otherwise it gets thrown out. When it comes to the community perceptions, you know, when we talk about integration, one of the great things about Canada is that we are very overtly pro-Muslim in that sense. I mean, you know, we talk openly about, the Prime Minister has been very, very open and very good in that regard. This is exactly, you know, how you produce people like me, if I can say that. You know, I did come back to a newfound appreciation for being Canadian and what that means. And I think this is one of the reasons why, you know, there's a million Muslims in Canada, and there's an extremely low amount of individuals who are caught up in these sorts of investigations. So that's part of the proof that a better integration policy equals lower terrorism threat.
So you don't have the extreme vetting that Donald Trump is talking about, but at the same time, it sounds like the incidences of domestic terrorism are much fewer, right? Notwithstanding that you helped roll up the Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorist group, the Toronto 18. So how do the statistics compare? Because the main criticism of Donald Trump's executive action, which clearly was poorly implemented and has created a great deal of confusion and an enormous backlash with demonstrations, is, first of all, it's completely misplaced. The seven Muslim nations that he mentioned on the list, none of them have been responsible. Nobody from any of those countries. The people behind 9/11 came from, 15 of the 19 came from Saudi Arabia, and the rest came from Egypt, the UAE, and Lebanon. So that on the surface, and it's glaring to think, well, Saudi Arabia, how come it's not on the list? Pakistan, Afghanistan, where the nightclub shooter down in Orlando came from, etc. So can you make a comparison here between Canada's more welcoming attitude to immigrants from Muslim lands and the homegrown terrorist aspect, or the importation of terrorism via refugees, which is the excuse for this Muslim ban, when in fact I think almost all of the terrorist attacks in the United States since 9/11 have come from homegrown terrorism as opposed to refugees?
Yeah, I mean, there's no actual logic to the ban. You know, one suggestion was that, well, look, President Obama previously identified these countries as dangerous countries. And look, out of those countries, only two really that I know of don't have an ISIS and or Al-Qaeda presence, or a significant one, at least ISIS, Iran and Sudan. I'm sure there are some jihadist elements in Sudan, but nothing really established per se. So on one side, you could say, well, all those countries do have ISIS. But on the other hand, as you indicated earlier, and it's based on a study by the Cato Institute, not exactly a, you know, left-leaning liberal paper, you know, from 1975 to 2016, they did the stats. And as you noted, not a single person from those countries committed those attacks. Now, the problem is that, well, if you then add to the list, well, then how you're going to reinforce the notion that this is a Muslim ban. They're trying to say that it's not a Muslim ban, but, I mean, let's be realistic. These are overwhelmingly Muslim countries. So there is no logic to it. There's no national security utilitarian value here, as most, the overwhelming majority of security experts, even partisan ones, but more importantly, the nonpartisan, non-biased ones, are all saying this makes it worse. The narrative of this being a war on Islam, a targeting of Islam, is a bonanza for ISIS. I can tell you, as somebody who was training field psychological operators for not just the U.S. military but other coalition forces, this is a propaganda victory for ISIS. So, you know, the utilitarian value is not there. There's no logical reason. And the propaganda element is also something no longer in our favor.
So just in going back to the suspect then, the French-Canadian, I think he's in his early 20s, isn't he, Alexander?
27,
yeah. Alexander Bissonnette. You say he was inspired by both Marine Le Pen and Donald Trump?
No. What I'm saying is that, you know, sort of like how we look at a jihadist social media profile, we look to see if there's any overt statements of anything. You know, did he like certain Facebook pages? Well, in this case, there's nothing overt on his page except for him liking Donald Trump, Marie Le Pen, and others. And of course, you know, liking a page doesn't necessarily mean that you support, but actually sometimes it does, right? This is what we're seeing from the social media scrubbing of his profile. At least he did show that. People who have been interviewed, like ex-classmates, etc., were very clear. Yeah, he had these views. He was shy. He was timid. Maybe that's why there wasn't so much overt preaching on his Facebook page. But certainly he was engaged in trolling on a Facebook page, a pro-refugee Facebook page. So he did express these views, and I'm sure you are going to see some of those views screenshotted and captured and then produced for public viewing.
Well, finally then, Mubin Sheikh, how did he get a gun? I don't know what kind of
That's the big question. That is the big question. You know, the AK-47 is a prohibited weapon in Canada. You cannot possess it no matter what. And this is going to be a major part of the investigation. Where did he get a weapon like that? Are there other weapons? I'm sure his premises is being searched as we speak, if it hasn't already been searched. And as they gather the evidence, you know, then they have to decide which of that evidence they can actually make public without there being an appearance of bias, you know, towards the suspect. The police, the government, they have to keep it very professional. I know as a fact witness who sat in court for 4 years, they have to be painstakingly clear. So the evidence, this is why they're saying there's no, you know, they're not commenting on what the motivation is. We have a pretty good idea what that motivation is, but pretty good idea is not evidence.
But just in closing, though, wouldn't it be easy for Canadian criminals or would-be terrorists to get an AK-47 in the United States?
It is not easy. It is not easy. In Canada.
No, I'm talking about in the United States, next door. Can they?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's. I mean, this is again. Yeah, one of the things that they're going to look at is, you know, where did he get the gun from? It may lead back to the U.S. I mean, the group that I was undercover in, the Toronto 18, before I was sent in to infiltrate the group, the individuals had gone to the U.S. and tried to smuggle some guns back into Canada. So. It's very possible and highly likely that it originated in the U.S. But once again, I'll wait for the police to confirm that.
Well, Mubin Sheikh, I thank you very much for joining us today from Canada.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mubin Sheikh, who became radicalized with the Taliban and was deeply involved in jihadism until the 9/11 attacks, after which he questioned his extremist interpretation of Islam. He then spent two more years studying Islam in Syria, where he came to see how his extremism was inconsistent with the teaching of the Quran, and returned to Canada in 2004 and became an undercover counterterrorism operative for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service. He's one of the few people in the world to have been undercover in Al-Qaeda-inspired domestic terror groups, and Mubin has testified in multiple legal hearings, resulting in the prosecution and conviction of 11 aspiring terrorists, which he wrote about in his book, Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, Al-Qaeda-inspired homegrown terrorism in the West. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the extent to which Donald Trump is endangering the 7,000 U.S. soldiers and contractors who are fighting alongside Iraqis against the Islamic State.
I am a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through this world alone. There's no sickness, toil or danger in that bright land to which I go. I'm going there to see my
اكتب وخط بالقلم بالقلم اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com, and is the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks again.
And the Muslim ban by President Trump that has pretty much inflamed the Islamic world, seven countries, none of which have had any recent history of exporting terrorism to the United States, and whereas the countries that have had a history, particularly Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and Afghanistan, are not on the list. So that in itself has created quite a lot of anger. But let's just focus on what's happening in Iraq, and which is your specialty. It would seem that the two things that Trump has said recently, one at the CIA the other day where he said he'd redo the Iraq war and do it right this time and grab Iraq's oil, and then, of course, on top of that, this Muslim ban that names Iraq one of the seven countries whose citizens can no longer come to the United States.
Yes, the remarks about taking Iraq's oil that Mr. Trump made at the CIA angered the Iraqi public and officials. Muqtada Sadr, an important clerical leader, has been fulminating against the United States for some years, and this set him off. By the way, he also has objected to Trump's pledge to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, essentially recognizing the Israeli occupation of Arab East Jerusalem, and even threatened to raise militia to go and fight in Jerusalem against the U.S. embassy from Iraq. And with regard to the rest of the country, the parliamentarians denounced Trump's comments. The Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, who depends upon the United States in many ways, was more reserved, but even he objected. And he confessed he couldn't entirely understand what Mr. Trump meant by taking Iraqi oil. He said Iraqi oil obviously belongs to the Iraqi people. And he wondered, does Mr. Trump mean that during the era of the Bush administration's occupation of Iraq, it should have been better guarded by U.S. troops. He just couldn't understand what does Trump mean by that.
Well, there's an article in the Washington Post by John Allen, a retired Marine Corps general who led the International Coalition to Counter the Islamic State from 2014 to 2015, and Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, talking about how this, well, the title is Trump is Recklessly Reversing America's Progress in Iraq, saying how, you know, of course, we know from these demonstrations at airports that many of the people who've been blocked and they've had to get legal help to get out of jail or out of detention, immigration detention, were Iraqis, translators who work with the U.S. military. But in general, the thrust of this article is that Trump's taking a backward step, not a forward step in the fight against terrorism and seriously eroding a key Arab state that many Americans gave so much to free and then helped stabilize under two presidents. How do you see it?
Well, that's an awfully rosy way of putting it, but it certainly is the case that in 2014, ISIL grabbed 40% of Iraqi territory and has been responsible not only for establishing an extremely brutal state which has summarily executed people, but also at simultaneously has engaged in terrorism against American allies in Europe, as in Paris and in Brussels. So it is a big threat, and the one force that has stood against ISIL in Iraq has been the Baghdad government and its allies, the Kurds and the Shiite militias. And over the past 2.5 years, they have taken back most of Iraqi territory from ISIL and now are besieging ISIL's last stronghold in West Mosul in the north. It seems likely that over the next few months, ISIL will be completely defeated as a territorial entity, as a state, in Iraq. And of course, the United States has played a key role in all this because President Obama swung into action and offered air support, not only the United States, but allies, including France, but also and Britain, but also Obama reestablished an Iraq command and committed on the order of 4,000 or 5,000 U.S. Special Operations Forces for training, logistics, strategy, tactics, and calling in airstrikes, painting lasers on targets, and so forth. So some of these U.S. troops are at the front, not very far from it, at least. And they have had to cooperate with the Iraqi military, which in the nature of the case is now largely Shiite Muslim, and Shiite militias, many of them backed by Iran. And so the U.S. has, on the ground in Iraq, had a battlefield alliance with Iran, which neither country wants to talk about very much. So Mr. Trump simultaneously offended America's de facto Iranian allies by banning Iranians, and the Iranians slapped a reciprocal ban on Americans coming to Iran as a result, and then also offended the entire Iraqi nation. And even though it's unlikely that Prime Minister al-Abadi will listen to the angry voices in Parliament or in the mosques demanding a reciprocal ban on Americans, and there are some 2,000 U.S. civilian contractors of the Pentagon in Iraq helping with the military effort, and there are 5,000 other contractors for the State Department and other U.S. agencies, it's a little bit unlikely that they will be expelled or banned by the prime minister, despite the feeling in the country. But certainly Mr. Trump has created a hostile working environment, let us say, both for the 5,000 troops and for the U.S. contractors who are working in support of them, and deeply damaged American prestige and the possibility of American friendship with the Baghdad government going forward. I personally think that Trump has more or less de facto delivered Iraq definitively into Iranian hands by this action.
It's also, I think, surely, Juan Cole, having an effect on the Arab countries that haven't been banned by Trump. Saudi Arabia, where 15 of the 19 hijackers came, the Gulf states, where a couple of the 9/11 hijackers came from, and most of all, Egypt, where one of the hijackers came from. My sense is that won't this further isolate unpopular leaders like General Sisi in Egypt and the Saudi royal family by appearing to be, you know, they haven't said a word about this Muslim ban. And it does, I think, from my understanding of the Islamic world, this is a very personal insult that people feel, particularly in the Arab world, in these seven countries. So the ones that aren't named, they've got to be feeling it too, haven't they? Isn't that exacerbating the gulf between the rulers and the people?
I think that certainly the public in the Arab world more generally is incensed by these measures, which clearly are aimed at discriminating against Muslims. And it's a huge propaganda windfall for the radicals, ISIL and Al-Qaeda and others who are plotting against American allies like the Saudi and Egyptian government in the Middle East. ISIL is calling it a second win, a God-given opportunity, and so on and so forth, because the radicals in the Middle East are trying to argue to their countrymen that the United States is inimical to Islam, that it is attempting to destroy Islam, that it is an imperial power. And this argument doesn't have a complete purchase. I mean, there are many people in the Middle East of Muslim heritage who would very much like to be friends with the United States, not just governments. What ISIL has been frustrated by is how few people have accepted its message that one has to organize on the basis of a Muslim form of government, like a medieval caliphate kind of a papacy, and become militant and attack the West because otherwise it will destroy you. That's a message that the vast majority of the people in the Middle East of Muslim heritage reject. But when Trump acts as he did this weekend, it certainly creates the impression that the radicals are correct, and there's a great deal of enmity from the United States towards the Muslim people.
Well, they weren't really subtle about it, were they? They said, this is not a Muslim ban, but by the way, we're letting Christians in and not Muslims.
Yes. No, the wording of the executive order made it made it crystal clear that this order was directed at Muslims. And then former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani gave an interview yesterday in which he spilled the beans. He said that Trump had come to him and said he wanted to do a Muslim ban. He was aware that as such it would probably be unconstitutional and struck down by the courts. That could Giuliani work it into a form that would stand up legally? And Giuliani said, well, instead of looking purely at religion, I looked at danger. And so the seven countries chosen were ones in which there's a substantial ISIL presence, a kind of danger to the United States. That was the basis on which the executive order was worked up with Giuliani's input. So Giuliani admitted that this is a form of Muslim ban. It's just refigured to have a fig leaf of national security over it.
Well, but Trump has also, in his campaign, made a big deal about smashing the Islamic State and presumably doing better than Obama has. And I thought he was supposed to announce some big executive order on that, isn't he? Or I think what's happened is he's tasked the Pentagon to come up with a 30 days to come up with a plan to defeat ISIS, which sounds like pretty much the timetable, that's operating now in Mosul, where they've pretty much taken most of Mosul, and now they're just going to go across the river and get the rest of the Islamic State neutralized. And once that happens, that's pretty much a big territorial blow to them, isn't it, apart from what they hold in Syria?
Yes, once ISIL loses West Mosul, they will control no substantial populations in Iraq, just a few villages here and there, and there will be mopping up operations by the Iraqi army. I think they're doomed on a relatively short timetable to disappear as a state. They will, of course, continue to have capacity for terrorist operations in Baghdad and Iraq generally and even in Europe, but they will be demoted from being one of the world's new states with several million citizens to being a ragtag band of disillusioned former terrorists who might still, you know, be bitter enders and still try to blow things up from time to time. But they still will remain a force in eastern Syria, where they hold about half of Raqqa province and have substantial territory in Deir ez-Zor province on the Iraqi border. I presume that Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis has been tasked not only with helping roll them up finally in Iraq, but also with rolling them up in their capital of Raqqa in Syria itself. The difficulty so far that Mr. Obama faced is that there aren't a good, effective allies for the United States on the ground who are willing to go into Raqqa. Or who have the capacity of doing so. So far, the Syrian regime has shown little interest in taking on the ISIL because it holds, you know, some desert towns that aren't important to the regime. And Russia hasn't stepped up in this regard either. Turkey is securing some territory in the north of Syria near to Turkey's border, but hasn't shown interest in doing more than occasionally bombing ISIL. The Kurds have of northern Syria have stepped up, and they've been the most effective forces against ISIL. But they, and we have about 250 U.S. troops embedded with them, they are much more interested in shoring up a Kurdish autonomy in northern Syria rather than going south into ISIL territory, which is largely Arab and where they wouldn't be welcome. So the reason for which ISIL continues to hold so much territory, albeit thinly populated, in eastern Syria is that the Obama administration simply wasn't able to find a partner to cooperate with in the way that they did find such partners in Iraq, the Iraqi government, the Shiite militias, even Iran, and the Iraqi Kurds to some extent have all helped in this rolling up of ISIL in Iraq. But there aren't similar actors with capacity and will in Syria. And how exactly Trump is going to take Raqqa is beyond me, without perhaps a fairly large American invasion of eastern Syria, which would be extremely tricky.
Well, Juan Cole, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan, president of the Global Americana Institute. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and is the author of Engaging the Muslim World. And his latest book is The New Arabs, How the Millennial Generation is Changing the Middle East. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Trump's two out, one in executive order to scrap two regulations for each new one. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sydney Shapiro, the Vice President of the Center for Progressive Reform and the Chair of Administrative Law at Wake Forest University. He's one of the country's leading experts on administrative procedure and regulatory policy, and has written 10 books and has been a consultant to government agencies and has testified before Congress on regulatory subjects. He was a trial attorney with the Federal Trade Commission and Deputy Legal Counsel of the Secretary's Review Panel at the United States Department of Health, Education and Welfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sydney Shapiro.
Thank you very much.
So what do you make of this Donald Trump's, he calls it this executive order, two out, one in. This is an executive order to kill two regulations for every new regulation. And it seems as though it's almost like a retail sales gimmick, you know, two for the price of one. How serious could this be? I mean, how can you just decide that if you have a new regulation, you therefore have to kill off two existing regulations just because of this mathematical mandate?
Well, an important point for your listeners to understand is that the president cannot just make this happen, even assuming this is a rational thing to do, which it is not. Executive orders are sort of like your boss in the workplace, and we all have bosses. And so if your boss says to you, hey, go do this, because you work there and you probably want to continue working there, you actually try to carry out his orders. But agencies are subject to legal restrictions about when and how they can adopt new regulations. And those are going to impact an agency's ability to follow the president's orders ultimately.
So what is the actual process then of getting regulations in place in the first place? And once they're in, how can you undo them, particularly by this, what appears to be a rather arbitrary formula?
All of our agencies operate under a law called the Administrative Procedure Act. And the Administrative Procedure Act spells out the steps, procedural steps, that an agency has to take in order to adopt a new rule or get rid of an old one. And it's kind of a time-consuming process, but necessarily so, because the agency has to propose what it wants to do. Then it has to take public comments, and the public is welcome to comment, as often they do. And then the agency has to justify what it finally does in light of the public comments and the evidence it has compiled. So after completing all of that process for any rule and the two that are going to be replaced, then the agency is subject to judicial review. And our courts have said the following, that in order to get rid of a rule, you have to justify why you're getting rid of it. You simply can't do it because you want to. And you have to justify getting rid of it in terms of your statutory mandate. So a statute might say, protect consumers from banks going broke, or protect consumers from eating bad food that'll make them ill. All these statutes are protective of consumers. So you have to be able to satisfy the court that getting rid of a rule satisfies this protective mandate. And if, in fact, the agency was correct in issuing the rule in the first place, it's not going to be able to do that. It simply won't have the evidence to justify getting rid of the rule. Finally, and hardly last of all, the Supreme Court has said that it's not good enough for an agency to justify getting rid of a rule merely to say, well, the president wants to do it, and after all, I work here. What the Supreme Court has said is that the president, too, has to justify getting rid of the rule in terms of the statutory mandate. In other words, both the agency and the president have to explain why getting rid of the rule is consistent with the protective mandate of the agency.
So this sort of Sophie's Choice type of mechanism that Donald Trump has set up today at this photo opportunity, where his son-in-law, of course, was present And he has a lot of clout, apparently, in this White House, along with, of course, Stephen Bannon, who's apparently the real power behind the scenes here at this new White House. It seems so, again, arbitrary, because just because you have a regulation, it's not a numerical question of how the regulations are, and it's more about whether they are onerous or not. So if you, for example, if the EPA wants to get a new regulation in to, say, stop mercury poisoning or lead poisoning affecting kids, then they would have to get rid of two existing laws, you know, to protect clean air and get lead out of drinking water. I mean, I'm struggling here to try and figure out if there's a logical basis to this, or if this is some kind of political stunt.
Well, I'm not sure it's a logical basis, because it's not true. But their assumption seems to be that there are a lot of old regulations lying around, which are imposing costs on industry that are not needed anymore. And so it'll be a very simple matter, if you want a new regulation, to identify a couple of these old ones that are no longer necessary, and then you'll be able to do your new regulation. The mistake, of course, is the assumption. I don't know of any evidence, in fact, that there are a lot of existing regulations that we don't need anymore. And there's certainly not enough to do a two-for-one trade, even assuming that was true. So it really is a Sophie's choice, as you state. And what may end up happening is an agency is going to have to say, well, I guess we can't protect consumers over there and over there because we have to protect them here. And that simply does not make any sense.
So is this possible then that this is just some sort of, you know, campaign trail promise that sounds good in theory, but actually has no basis in fact? I mean, what you just said makes an awful lot of sense. If there are a bunch of regulations that have been sitting around since, I think, the Regulatory Act that you talked about came in 1946, didn't it?
Yes.
So if these old regulations that are no longer relevant exist, identify them. I mean, let's no effort's been made to do that, right?
Well, no, of course not. As we learned about the immigration order that was just issued, the White House issued it without consulting with anyone, including the State Department or Homeland Security, and that was in large part caused great confusion and had very unfortunate effects concerning people who were legally entitled to be here. And you get the impression they did the same thing here, that this seems to make sense to them. They didn't really consult anyone whether or not, in fact, this is going to work. And in fact, it's not going to work. At the end of the day, we're going to have a lot of lawsuits, a lot of litigation. The courts are going to turn this back. And in the meantime, there'll be 3 or 4 or 5 years of enormous turmoil in the regulatory system as these agencies are tied up in litigation. So if there's any logic to this, maybe it is just to tie up these agencies forever in litigation, and so they won't be able to get anything done for the next 4 years.
Well, that is about the only thing so far that makes any sense. But then on the other hand, we live in a country where only a few years ago, the Wall Street crashed because of deregulation or the lack of regulations, and we almost had a depression. We had the huge BP oil spill in the Gulf because of lax enforcement of regulations. And I could go on about all of these incidents. So where do you think the public stands on this? Surely at some point or other, the public must recognize that all of this propaganda about, you know, big business having its hand tied and not being able to function, and somehow our jobs will all, you know, suddenly we'll be flooded with jobs and opportunity, and the economy will grow leaps and bounds because we'll take the handcuffs off big business. There's no evidence that the handcuffs are on big business to begin with. But so where do you think the public stands in their recognition of the fundamental value of regulation?
The public opinion polling on this is really schizophrenic. If you ask the public in general about government or has government done more harm than good, the polling pretty consistently has shown 50-60%, maybe even a few more Americans, will say, oh, the government's done more harm than good. But then when you ask people about specific regulatory programs, should we have more or less environmental protection? Should we have more or less protection for our food? Should we have more or less protection for our workers? Then a vast majority, often 70-80% of Americans say, yeah, I want clean air. We ought to have more of it. Yeah, I want my food to be healthy. I don't want to get sick from my food. So we see in the opinion polling a really sort of schizophrenic attitude. So at the moment, and this is why it's great that your program is getting into this, I would guess a lot of people in the public are just sort of looking at this, and it's fairly abstract, and goodness knows who in the heck has ever heard of the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act. And so Americans might well say, or at least many of them, oh, good, you know, government's too big, maybe this is a good idea. But as soon as we have some specific examples of agencies crashing and burning and not being able to regulate, let alone, God forbid, a crisis like one of the ones you just mentioned, then I think you're going to see a pretty strong public reaction.
Well, this is also, this initiative from the White House, this executive order that we're talking about, is also on the very same day House Republicans began to kill five Obama-era rules on the environment, labor, and gun control, as well as corruption. The House Rules Committee is sending to the full chamber measures axing regulations, the stream protection rules on water, the Securities and Exchange Commission's resource extraction rule, Social Security Administration's expanded background checks on disabled gun buyers, and so forth. So this is not just happening at the executive branch.
That's true, and unfortunately, that's only one of several efforts in Congress to roll back regulation. But this one is under something called the Congressional Review Act, which Congress passed about 15, maybe even 18 years ago, but it's only used once until now. So under the Congressional Review Act, an agency has to submit a regulation and give Congress the opportunity to pass a law signed by the president to stop that regulation from going into effect. So this is the first time, really, that there's probably a significant chance that the law will be used in any kind of wholesale fashion. And so the House has started this process concerning the bills that you mentioned. There's two really bad aspects to the Congressional Review Act. For all the regulations you mentioned, it's taken agencies years to develop those. And they went through that robust process I described earlier. They got public comments. They looked at the evidence. They really gave careful consideration, and often they got sued, and the regulations are upheld by the public, by the courts eventually. Here, the House of Representatives and the Senate have to make their decision under fast-track procedures, which don't include any hearings on the merits of the bill, and very limited floor time to debate the bill. So Congress is really overruling this expertise and consideration in a very kind of truncated process. The second problem is there's a provision in the Congressional Review Act that once Congress vetoes a regulation in this way, the agency can never go back and regulate in the same area. It takes out that whole chunk of regulatory area and says you can never do this again. So they're not only getting rid of these particular regulations, they're preventing future administration from ever regulating in that area again. And remember, they're doing all this with just about 10 hours of floor debate or less.
Well, but if the public knew, for example, what's going on in the House, what the, you know, when you say the STREAM Act or the STREAM rule, they don't realize that that's a rule that prevents coal mining, particularly mountaintop removal coal mining waste, from contaminating water sources, which it clearly does. And it's devastated West Virginia and a lot of these other states. And of course, coal is going out of business because of Wall Street, not because of Obama, because the price of natural gas is so much more competitive. The extraction rule, for example, requires these big companies like ExxonMobil to publicly state how much they pay governments in taxes and other fees, and it's designed to increase transparency and reduce corruption. So that's, to my mind, that's the problem, is that you don't have enough Democrats to stop the Republicans. They've got the majority, but are the public aware of what these guys are doing?
No, probably not. Again, that's why I'm glad you're having this program. This is a very cynical attempt to really take advantage of the fact that we know from the academic literature that people understandably only have so much time in the day to pay attention to what government does. And so people are generally ill-informed. Not because they're not well-meaning, and not because they're not educated to understand what happens. It's just we got to earn a living. We got to take the kids to soccer games. We have to put dinner on the table in the evening, and with all of that, it's really hard to keep up. And then when you have, as you say, a rule that sounds innocuous, you know, the Waters of the United States rule. And people are not going to really recognize what this rule does and why it's important. So they're really exploiting that, taking advantage of that.
And as you pointed out, just in closing, the cynical purpose may be of this strange and arbitrary two-for-one deal, where you, for every new regulation, you've got to strike down two old ones or two existing ones, that it may be designed simply to paralyze all regulations because of the blizzard of lawsuits that will entail. So I thank you for filling us in on this, Sidney Shapiro.
My pleasure. And again, thank you for looking into this. It's very important.
And again, I've been speaking with Sidney Shapiro, who's the Vice President of the Center for Progressive Reform and the Chair of Administrative Law at Wake Forest University. He's one of the country's leading experts in administrative procedure and regulatory policy, and has written 10 books and has been a consultant to government agencies and has testified before Congress on regulatory subjects. He was a trial attorney with the Federal Trade Commission and a deputy legal counsel of the Secretary's review panel at the United States Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down to the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.